أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وخاتم النبيين وسيد المرسلين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، ولعنة الله الدائمة على أعدائهم أجمعين، من ليلتنا هذه إلى يوم الدين. My respected Sheikh, elders, brothers and sisters in Islam and Iman, Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, we have gathered here to remember and commemorate our devotion to Sayyidatu Nisa al-Alameen, Sayyida Fatimah al-Zahra, Salamallahi alayha.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
And when we have such gatherings, I like to remind myself, first and foremost, and all of you, secondly, of the importance of being thankful for the blessing of being able to remember the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and to have them be part of our lives. We put aside those other things and make this be the priority. One of the titles of Sayyida Fatima is that she is Al-Muhaddatha, the one to whom the angels would descend upon and speak to. This was a lady who was not a prophet. This was a lady who was not an imam. But yet she had reached the level, the spiritual status of the prophets and of the imam, such that the angels would wish to descend upon her and speak with her. Until one day, she tells her husband and her imam that, "Oh Ali, I have angels who are coming to talk to me. They are telling me things. Will you write them down for me?" And he takes up his pen and he scribes that which she hears from the angels, and it becomes known as Mus'haf of Fatima, salamullahi alayha. The imams after them would refer to this book and it would have within it spiritual and mystical secrets. There was one time that not only was it the case that the angels were descending upon her, but one special angel, that same angel that was only sent to the prophets to convey the revelation, that angel that was among the best, or perhaps the best of all of creation, among the angels, which is Jibreel alayhi salam, where Allah sends him for a special mission to Sayyida Fatima. What is this special mission that he has to accomplish? According to hadith, it was during these days, after the death of Rasulullah, where the grief of Sayyida Fatima was such that she needed the angel Jibreel alayhi salam to come to her, to console her, and to comfort her grief. Today is the day that we celebrate life in the form of spring. It's a day that we're told to remember this miracle of Allah that is unfolding in front of our very eyes. It's a day that we're supposed to remember life, not only in the physical sense, but in the spiritual sense, and to ask Allah to revive our hearts. For some of us, like myself, our dead hearts. And to ask Allah and plead to Him, Ya, that, oh, Ya, Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To make the dua, Ya Muhawwilul Hawli wal Ahwal, Hawwil Halana ila Ahsanil Ahwal. Oh, the one who transforms the conditions and the states, transform our condition in our state to the most perfect of conditions and states. But as we celebrate life in the world, outside of us, we are celebrating, or we are commemorating rather, and remembering the tragedy of one life which is slowly, slowly going to leave this world, which is the life of our great lady, Sayyidah Fatimah al-Zahra, salamu alayhi alayha. On the occasion of remembering her and remembering that pure household, the house of Fatima alayha salam, the topic that I've chosen, that I began last night and that I wish to continue tonight, is the topic of tarbiyah. As we explained last night, tarbiyah is the process of taking something stage by stage until it reaches perfection. And tarbiyah is not something which is limited to just children. It's not just something that parents do for children, but rather it's something that we're all meant to go through. All of us are supposed to be the subject of tarbiyah of Allah, the Murabbi. We talked last night about one fundamental principle that we have regarding tarbiyah, which is the principle of prevention before cure. When it comes to spiritually harmful elements, whether they be spiritually harmful environments, whether they be spiritually harmful friends, whether it be ideas, whether it be media, in all these situations, the first principle that I should have towards them is the one of understanding that they are dangerous, and coming near them, if I don't have to be near them, is a source of great danger for me. When a parent is raising a child, from the very beginning, they're always concerned about the child's physical health. You've seen new parents in particular, how they're so careful about what happens to their baby. Even the slightest of cries, they rush to the side of the baby to see, God forbid, is anything harming them? Is there a clothing that maybe has gotten in their way? Is something maybe tied a little bit too tight? Whatever it is, they're there for them. They want to make sure that not even the slightest harm comes to them. Now, do they know that at the same time they have to be working at strengthening the body of the child? Do they know that they have to be preparing the child for one day being able to walk on their own two feet and to be able to go away from them, even leave their presence and be alone? Of course, they know that. But the strategy that they take to prepare the child for that is not to throw them into dangerous situations and have them figure out what to do in order to take care of themselves. They protect them. They preserve them. They keep them away from those dangerous environments. They don't even let them get close to those dangerous environments because they're concerned about the health of their child. The topic I want to address tonight in particular is how do we take this principle of prevention before cure and apply it to our viewing of media. Now, I'm not going to even talk about that media which is outright bad and haram. That's something, inshallah, that mu'mineen have realized that they have no sort of motivating factor to even be considering watching those type of things. But I want to come to this fundamental question that we hear asked again and again. If there is nothing which is overtly haram taking place, or if I turn away at the time when something is being shown to me, which is haram, but I watch the rest of the stuff, and I don't feel like I'm being affected by it, what is wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with that or not? Now, in order to answer this, first of all, I want to look at the words of one of our maraji, Ayatollah Sistani, hafidhahullah, where he was asked this question regarding the viewing of serials and dramas. Before researching this topic for the speech, I hadn't come across this particular fatwa. Perhaps it's something that's new. It's very interesting that a marja would speak in this way about this concept of viewing serials and dramas. Let's see what it is that Ayatollah Sistani says on this topic. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Question, what is the ruling regarding seeing dramas and serials? And then the question is that whether they be in Arabic or whether they be in a foreign language. Now, what is the answer that he gives right here? He says that when these serials and dramas include scenes which are, number one, haram, but he doesn't just stop there. Number two, when they contain scenes that are غَيْرُ أَخْلَاقِيَّ, that go against the Islamic ethical framework. And then he goes on to say that usually they contain these things. Then he says that it is haram to look at them if somebody does so with the shahwa, that haram pleasure, number one. Or number two, when they fear falling into haram, then it's haram to do that. But he doesn't just stop there. He says rather, and in the technical language of fiqh, basically now he's going beyond the common opinion regarding this, and he's expressing something new here. What is he saying? But rather, it is ihtiyat-e wajib to leave aside and to not look at them even if somebody doesn't have the shahwa, even if they don't have fear of falling into haram. It's ihtiyat-e wajib to stay away from these types of serials and dramas. Now, this is a fiqhi ruling. It's something that we could discuss on a fiqhi level, but that's not my purpose tonight. What I'd like to do is to see if we can understand what is it that takes place on a spiritual dimension when somebody is exposed to viewing programs, TV shows, and serials which contain haram elements. In order to do this, I want to look at some of the beautiful teachings regarding the soul and the effect of such views and such effect of such scenes and exposure to such media on the soul from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Let us see what they have to guide us in this regard. The first point of reference I would like to refer you to is a tradition we have, which is reported from our sixth Imam, Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Somebody asks the Imam alayhi salam, he says that is it allowed for us to listen to somebody who tells lies in the form of stories? There were people who would be beautiful storytellers, but what they would see, what they would say would be filled with lies and misinformation. The Imam alayhi salam responds and he says, no, it's not permissible. And then he goes on to explain why. See, the Imams would want us to understand things. This understanding is crucial. I encourage especially the younger brothers and sisters who are present tonight, to ask this question of what is it that the Imams want from us and why. He says the following. He says that man asgha ila naqitin faqad abadahu, somebody who listens to somebody who speaks. Okay, if somebody listens, not just hears, if somebody listens, let me give my ear to somebody who's speaking, what is the consequence of that? Whoever does that, فَإِنْ كَانَ النَّاطِقُ عَنِ اللَّهِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ اللَّهِ وَإِنْ كَانَ النَّاطِقُ عَنِ الْإِبْلِيسِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ إِبْلِيسِ. Whoever listens to somebody who speaks, he worships him. And if that person who speaks speaks from the words of Allah and speaks the truth, then he has worshipped Allah. But if he is speaking the words of the shaitan, then he has worshipped the shaitan. Now, if we haven't come across this tradition before, maybe we might think that worshipping is a matter of just getting involved in ritual sorts of actions of prostrating and bending and bowing, these sorts of things. But this and traditions like it, they expand our understanding of what does it mean to worship somebody. Worshipping in the terminology of the Quran, in the Ahlul Bayt, goes beyond just these types of actions. Somebody, the Imam alayhi salam tells us that somebody who just listens to somebody is worshipping them. That's tradition number one. Now question that comes up is that how? What is it about listening to somebody that causes us to fall into their worship? In another tradition, this is answered for us. This tradition is from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He says that مَنْ عَلَّمَ شَخْصًا مَسْأَلَةً فَقَدْ مَلَكَ رَقَبَتَهُ. Somebody who teaches somebody something. Part of teaching, of course, is listening, of opening your mind and opening your heart and asking your teacher, please fill that mind and please fill that heart with whatever you have to offer me. Somebody who teaches, the Rasulullah says, somebody who teaches somebody some matter, he owns his neck. That's a literal expression. What it figuratively means is that he becomes his master and that pupil becomes his slave. Now, somebody happens to be there. He's a bit of an opportunist. He seems like he's a businessman. He says that, okay, does that mean that the teacher can then sell his student? Rasulullah says that no. It's not like that. It's not the case that he can sell him. But rather, what is the secret behind this? وَلَكِنْ يَأَمُرُهُ وَيَنْهَاهُ. But he now commands him and he prohibits him. Do you see now the connection? There's a connection that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimussalam are making, that when we expose ourselves, when we give ourselves, or give our ear, lend ourselves to exposure by somebody who's talking to us and giving us messages and teaching us things, then we're subjecting ourselves to being commanded by them and being prohibited by them. We're being told what to do. And that is a form of worshipping them. Now, take this. This is a foundation for us to now go into a little bit more detail. And I want to take you now to the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, where he describes the way that shaitan comes and attacks us. Why do I want to focus on this part now? This goes back to something that perhaps you may be familiar with. When I know myself, when it was a time when we were about to be blessed with our first child, one of the things that was recommended to me was to read the dua from Sahifa Suchadadiya regarding the prayer of a parent for his child. Perhaps you've seen this prayer before. It's one of the du'as of the Sahifa Sajadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Now, this du'a is a very beautiful du'a. I would encourage everyone to read this, whether you be a parent, whether you be a child, whether you be a soon-to-be spouse, whether you be married, thinking maybe in the future, whatever it is, this is a very beautiful du'a. All of these du'as are worlds of information and guidance for us. I remember back at that time, I was reading this du'a, and the Imam alayhi salam gave such beautiful points about what to pray for in a child. Line after line after line. It's not a very long dua. About halfway through, however, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam switches the topic. He starts talking about something else. He starts talking about the shaitan. He says, "Oh Allah, keep my progeny, my children away from the shaitan." And then he starts to go on. Shaitan is this, shaitan is this. This is the way that shaitan pounces on a human being, and this is what he does to him. He threatens him with waswas, and then he attacks through shahwa, and this thing and that thing. And then finally, at the end of the dua, then Imam al-Islam makes some dua for himself and for all the mu'mineen. And then at the very end, he mentions his children once again. I remember reading it that first time and thinking to myself that, okay, maybe they should have titled the dua something else, like the dua for children and also staying away from shaitan and also for general welfare of human beings. But when we go back and look at that dua more carefully, we realize something extremely important, which is that part of raising a child, a fundamental part of it, it takes up three paragraphs of that dua, is number one, understanding the role of the shaitan in trying to take away those whom we're trying to raise. And number two, defending against his attacks. It's so important that one third of this dua is dedicated just to explain the way that shaitan is going to come, is going to try to undo that tarbiyah that we're trying to do for our children. So what that means is that if we're concerned about the tarbiyah of our children, or we're concerned about the tarbiyah of ourselves, then we need to understand the way that shaitan is going to come and attack us. Now, I want to mention one description of this from Nahj al-Balagha. Imam Ali Islam talks about it in many places. But we'll use this then to look at this issue that I brought up at the beginning regarding these TV shows, these dramas, and these serials. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Imam alayhi salam is describing people who have taken the shaitan as their criterion, meaning that they have now adopted a friendship with the shaitan. They've become partners with the shaitan. He doesn't just condemn them. He doesn't just say that these people are lost. He tries to explain to us the way that shaitan has gone and gotten them. Number one, اتخذوا الشيطان لأمرهم ملاكا. They've taken the shaitan as their criteria. Now when somebody opens the door to the shaitan, what happens? Does the shaitan just stand there? No. He takes this up and he takes this offer and he accepts it. What does he do? وَاتَّخَذَهُمْ لَهُ أَشْرَاكَ. He takes them as partners. What happens? What is the spiritual reality that takes place when somebody lets shaitan in the door? The Imam describes, فَبَاضَ وَفَرَّجَ فِي صُدُورِهِمْ وَدَبَّ وَدَرَجَ فِي حُجُورِهِمْ. The Imam alayhi salam explains that the job of the shaitan once he's let in is that he gets into the heart and then he lays eggs. He lays his eggs. Now you know that in order for an animal to lay eggs, there has to be a proper environment. So somebody can get to the point where their inner soul becomes a favorable environment to foster the development of the eggs of the shaitan. This is an expression that Imam alayhi salam is describing the level of unity that can occur when somebody opens the door to the shaitan. But notice the way he describes it. He says that fabada, he lays his eggs. An egg doesn't hatch right away. The egg is hatched. It takes time. Sometimes days, sometimes weeks, sometimes even more than a month in order for the reality to unfold. But what happens is that eventually these eggs are going to hatch and the byproduct will come out. And what happens at that point is that people themselves become shayateen. Shaitan isn't just somebody who's out there. Shaitan is somebody who penetrates our very nature. What does he do then? The Imam alayhi explains. He says, فَنَظَرَ بِأَعْيُنِهِمْ وَنَطَقَ بِأَلْسِنَتِهِمْ. Shaitan comes and he takes over their senses. They see with the eyes of the shaitan and they speak with the tongue of the shaitan. Now this is a scary sort of scene right here. Imagine being possessed. We talk about this concept of being possessed. It's something that typically we're scared about. They talk about it in the movies. But it's something which happens at a spiritual level when somebody opens the door to the shaitan. Now, how is it that the shaitan can be allowed into our inner souls? What we just saw from those traditions is that one of the ways is by giving our ears to the shaitan. When somebody speaks and they're speaking on behalf of the shaitan, we're worshipping them, we're allowing them to come inside. I want to give the example of what happens when our children and ourselves, na'udhu billah, we expose ourselves repeatedly to TV serials. Now why am I choosing this particular topic of serials? Why am I choosing this topic in general? Because as somebody who has the honor of being involved in education, there are times when I speak to my students and I feel that I have a connection with them. Alhamdulillah. But there are other times when I'm saying things which are right, inshallah. And there are other students who are listening to them, inshallah. But there are some students who cannot listen. It's not that they can't, that they're not there, they're hearing, but they can't listen. And this is something that really worries me. When I see that somebody is listening, when somebody is hearing, but they can't listen. And I realize that the reason is because there's somebody else who's talking to them. There's somebody else who they're listening to. And those words are preventing my words from being heard by that individual. And this is not a unique phenomenon. It's not just me. Every teacher that you talk to, they know that glazed look and that apathy and that deadness that emits from somebody who is giving their ear to one of these talkers. Let's look at this concept of a serial. Right now, there are certain TV shows and certain movies that people are engaged in watching. Some of our good mu'mineen families, unfortunately, they've fallen into this trap. They say that, no, it's on public TV, it's TV 14 or whatever it is. It's okay for us to watch it. We saw it, there's nothing haram about it. And our children are getting exposed to this repeatedly again and again. You know, the nature of a serial is that the way that they produce it is they come up with a story and they plan the story over a whole season. And every time they have an episode, they leave you with a cliffhanger. They don't tell you everything. They leave you in a state of suspense, and the next week they come back and they continue where they left off. You know where this type of thing came from? You must have heard of this thing called the Tales of Arabian 1001 Arabian Nights. There was once a king, his name was Shahryar, right? For some reason that they explain, he became upset at women, all women. And he vowed that, okay, from now on, I'm going to marry a woman every single day, and the next day I'll have her killed. Everyone got scared. They said that pretty much everyone's, half of our kingdom is going to be gone, because eventually he'll marry all the women and they'll be gone. But there was one smart woman who was the daughter of the wazir. She says that, okay, well, let me go and marry him. Obviously her father is like, what? You know, I'm not going to let you go and marry him. But she insists, she's wise, she's smart. Finally, he says, okay, they agreed, she gets married. Now what does she do is that the first night she begins to tell him a story. And she gets it to the point where she's about to reveal the punchline or whatever, the epitome, the best part of the story. And she says, okay, we have to stop here. I can't tell you the rest of the story. And the Shahryar, right, he says, okay, fine, well, one more night, not a problem. Tomorrow I'll have her killed. Next night, same thing happens, another story, next night. And then she has a story within a story, a story within the story, so on and so forth. For 1001 nights, they say that she continues. I'm not sure what happens after that, actually. Anyhow, this is an age-old technique, brothers and sisters. We need to understand where it came from, what it's being used for. It was so powerful that it took this maniac Shah and was allowed him to completely swerve his course. It's a powerful technique. But what is it doing? Number one, is that when we watch these types of shows, we have to understand that reality is being dictated to us by a human being, not by the one who is the owner of reality. What happens to the characters, the challenges that they face, the development that takes place, or the opposite of development that takes place, those who fall, those who lie, those who die, those who live, all of that is being written by another individual. Why should I expose myself to a reality other than the most beautiful reality, which is the world that Allah has created me for me? Point number two. Is that when they leave me in that state of suspense, they tell me that I have to come back at this time, at this day, and I have to be exactly on time, otherwise I'm going to miss out on that. Now, if you ask me, the only time that that's appropriate is a job interview. When I'm looking for a job, that's when they can tell me what to do to that level of precision. I can't even believe be a single minute late. No, you can't, otherwise you're going to miss out on it. No, but here I'm being dictated to. No, I have to understand this. I'm being told, it goes beyond that as well. What's happening now is that some of these become so popular that if one of our children does not watch this, they immediately become an outcast in the classroom. Because the only topic of conversation which is spoken about is what happened in the last week's serial. Sometimes, you know, our educators sometimes say that we think that maybe even some of the students, you know, actually lie about it. They say that we watched it. You know, they couldn't have watched it because we saw them, they were at mosque that night. So they couldn't have watched it. But because they, otherwise they'll be just left out. They'll be like, who are you? Do you know? Now, is that not a form of dictatorship that I must watch it? And that even creating this social pressure to make me watch that? It goes beyond that. And this is just a superficial analysis of what's happening with these shows. When I'm left with this taste of suspense, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, what starts happening? Is I start thinking about it. Okay, what's going to happen here? This person is going to do that. What with that person? Yes, last time they had this type of relationship. What's going to happen next time? Last time she did what with whom? What is she going to do with whom next time? And so on and so on. All these types of thoughts. And these thoughts start to take root. And my entire imagination gets occupied with this sort of thinking. Sometimes it even comes into the dreams as well too. This is not a small matter, brothers and sisters. When somebody is successfully able to own our spare thought processes, this is a very dangerous proposition. There was once a man who was among a very well-to-do person, considered to be a mu'min, and he lives his life. At the end of his life, he's on his deathbed, and like the normal tradition is, they start asking him to do the shahadatain and do dhikr of Allah. It's a time now when he's about to leave this world. However, when he tries to do dhikr of Allah, instead this one line of poetry keeps on coming from his mouth. One of the lines is this: Aina tariqu ila hammamil manjab? Where is the path to the bathhouse of Manjab? Now people around him are thinking, what is going on here? We're telling him to do la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah. Instead he's talking about a bathhouse of Manjab. Till the end, until that point where he dies, the only thing that can come from his mouth is, where is the path to the bathhouse of Manjab? And he dies in this state. Everyone's confused. They don't know what's going on. Later on, they do some investigation. They find out from his memoirs what this whole situation is about. They realize that many, many, many years ago, when he was a young person, there was an incident that took place. Now, I don't want to go into the details of that incident, but let's just say that the incident left him with this question regarding the presence of somebody from the opposite gender. She was in his clutches, but then she escaped from him. And he knew that she had gone on her way to the bathhouse of Manjab. And this question had occurred for him, which is the way to that bathhouse of Manjab so that I can go and find this person. When did that question arise for him? When he was a young person. But it took root in his heart. Remember, the shaitan lays those eggs. It took root in his heart and it developed and developed and did it until it became the whole motto of his life, which is, what is the way to the bathhouse of Manjab? And he dies with this as well too. These types of thoughts that people are able to put into our minds and our hearts and keep them there, and let us dwell upon them and discuss them and build them up for us, this is not a small matter. This territory is not a territory which is supposed to be for just anybody to walk into and stake claim for it. The heart is the sanctuary of Allah. فَلَا تُسْكِن فِي حَرَمِ اللَّهِ غَيْرَ اللَّهِ. Do not cause to live and dwell in the haram and the sanctuary of Allah except for Allah. This is what the Ahlul Bayt say for us. These are just some observations of these types of things, how it is that they play right into the tune of what the shaitan is trying to do. Now that's when it comes to just watching these types of shows. The Ahlul Bayt explained to us in detail this connection between watching and the effect that it has on our hearts. They tell us in one hadith that there is no part of the body which is more ungrateful than the eye. The eye is the thing which betrays the trust of Allah more than anything else. So what do they tell us? فَلَا تُعَطُوهَا سُؤَلَهَا. Do not give your eye everything it asks for if you should do so, it will divert you from the remembrance of Allah. Okay, this is a whole subject in and of itself. I don't wish to enter this one right now. But I do want to say this point, which is that when we're talking about our eyes and our ears and using them for the wrong purposes, we have to understand a fundamental purpose for why we've come here to this world. Let me give you the example of our teeth. Everyone is gifted with a set of teeth soon after they're born. They use those teeth, but after some time, those teeth run out of their purpose, meaning that they're used for their purpose, and then they start to disintegrate, go away, get decay, and break away. Eventually, they leave. And then Allah, in His beautiful generosity and mercy and the beautiful system with which He created this universe, He replaces those teeth with a set of permanent teeth that, alhamdulillah, we all enjoy and make use of. Now that is an analogy with teeth. We see it in the physical world. The same thing is supposed to happen in the spiritual sense when it comes to our organs. Those eyes that we've been gifted with since we were born, they too are supposed to be replaced with another set of eyes. Which eyes are those? It's the spiritual eyes of the heart, which allows us to see those realities that Allah has placed only for those who are deserving of them. Those ears that we have, they're supposed to be replaced with another set of ears. Which ears are they? And ears which are supposed to be able to hear that special guidance that Allah reserves for the muttaqeen. And so on and so forth with all the other organs of our body. Look at the verse of the Quran where Allah says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم لهم قلوب لا يفقهون بها ولهم آذان لا يسمعون بها ولهم أبصار لا يبصر ولهم أعين لا يبصرون بها. They have hearts, but they do not understand with these hearts. They have ears, but they cannot hear with these ears. They have eyes, but they cannot see with these eyes. Allah isn't speaking about people who are challenged or handicapped where they don't have eyes or ears. He's talking about human beings who have used these organs for shaitanic purposes. And just as Imam Ali explained in Nahj al-Balagha, shaitan has come and with his eggs that he has laid, they have hatched and now they've taken over the eyes and the ears. That's why we say in a dua, it's one of the most beautiful duas according to the ulama, those who have speciality in spirituality. Allahumma ij'al qalbi nura. O Allah, make my heart full of light. Wa sam'i nura, and my ears full of light. Wa basari nura, and my ears full of light. Wa rijali nura, and my legs and my entire being. O Allah, make it filled with light. This is why Sayyid Qadi Tabatabai, they say that he would frequently repeat this one line in his classes to his students. What is that one line? He used to say this, and it's a hadith that we have from Nabi Isa alayhi salam, which is the following: لَنْ يَلِجَ مَلَكُوتَ السَّمَاوَاتِ. No one will reach the inner dimensions and those sublime levels of the heavens except for somebody who has been born again. Born again meaning that this existence, the physical properties and the physical organs that we have, they've been replaced with a new set of spiritual such organs. Now this is just a bit. I wanted to hint at this point right here, brothers and sisters, that if we let ourselves be enslaved by the people who direct these types of shows and movies, then we're completely separating ourselves from this path that we're destined to take. But it goes further than that. And this is the thought I'll end with before going to the Masaib, which is the following: that fundamentally that we as believers are supposed to be disgusted when we see evil being done. Evil in the Islamic terminology is something called munkar. And what is wajib upon us is that when we see something evil being done, we should deny it in our hearts. And if we can, with our tongues, and if we can, even with our actions as well too. When we see an entire way of living that is based on anti-God themes, depravity, decadence, friendships of opposite gender, haram activities, and that's the way the whole thing is about, the whole plot is based on that thing, and we're watching it just to have a good time, then how can we do that and also be denying it in our hearts? We have to have that state of denial. Anything that is wrong, we should not be deceived and instead try to enjoy it. They say that Sayyid Bahrul Ulum, one of the great ulama, he used to live in Najaf. One time, he was a young boy, and his father was also an alim. The governor of the province came to visit his father to pay his respects. He knew that the ulama were to be feared, right? They were not legitimized like this type of rule, which was illegitimate. He goes to see him, and his son Sayyid Bahrul Ulum is there as well too. Now this governor, this official, he starts to praise the son. He makes some comments and then he leaves. Afterwards, the son comes to the father and he tells his father, he says that, "Oh my father, is it possible for us to move from here? I want to go to another city." What does the father say? He says that, "Oh my son, why is it that you want to go to another city?" He says that, "Because when the governor came home and he started praising me, I felt that distaste and dislike I have for the zalim of the time, it started to thaw out. I started to feel some feelings of affection towards him because of the praise that he has given me. And I'm concerned that Allah will destroy me because of not being able to have that feeling of hatred towards evil and the manifestations of evil in my heart." And what happens is they eventually move town because of this young boy's desire. Is that not the example for us, brothers and sisters? Is that the example of our pious ulama? That we need to raise children that not, is it, it's not the case that, oh, it's just a matter of not viewing the haram, but rather they should have that distaste and dislike that even if we bring them near to such things, they wouldn't imagine even wanting to engage with them. We ask Allah to help us to do our responsibility towards ourselves and all those whom we're responsible for. Sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala al-Tahirin. One more salawat, please. These are the nights in which we remember the tragedy of Sayyidatu Nisa al-Alameen. One of the most amazing things about this lady, and of course we're not qualified to speak about her, but when we look at what our ulama have said regarding her, they say that one of the most amazing things is that a lady who is only 18 or 19 years old can reach that spiritual level that the angels vie with each other to go visit her home. And one of the outstanding things that we see about her is the relationship she has with Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. In order for us to understand why is it that this is such a tragedy for Amir al-Mu'mineen and why these nights must have been so difficult for him, it's important for us to understand a little bit about this relationship between the two. When they were married, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi went to visit them soon afterwards. He asks Ali alayhi salam, he says that, "How did you find your wife? How did you find Fatima?" He tells him, "Ni'am al-aun ala ta'atillah." She is the best of helpers when it comes to worshipping Allah. He then asks Fatima, he says that, "How did you find your husband Ali?" She says that he is the best of husbands one could ask for. This is the quality of relationship that these two enjoyed. And this becomes an example for all of us. A relationship of mutual compatibility, a relationship of sacrifice, of both parties working to try to help each other to worship Allah, working to try to help each other towards the path of perfection. We can understand why it's the case then that this is such an important issue and why this is so difficult for Imam Ali alayhi salam. According to hadith, there was one time that those two companions wished to enter upon the house of Fatima. They want to go to her and they want to secure her pleasure. They have heard that she's very sick. They know that it's only a matter of a few days before she leaves this world. They want one more chance because they know those hadith where Rasulullah said that man aadhaha faqad aadhani, whoever troubles her has troubled me. Wa man aadhani faqad aadhallah, whoever troubles me has troubled Allah. So they seek permission to enter upon her. She refuses them. They then go to Amir al-Mu'mineen and they ask him that, oh Ali, can you go and perhaps ask Sayyida Fatima on our behalf? Imam Ali goes to her. He conveys the message. Look at the response that she has for him. She tells him, Ya Ali, al-baytu baytuk wal-hurratu zawjatuk. O Ali, the house is your house, and this woman is your woman. Do whatever it is that you wish. This is the type of adab, the type of respect that she had for him, and similarly that he had for her. We can see why then, in the last moments, we're told that Imam Ali alayhi salam is in the house of Fatima. It is soon when Sayyida Fatima will breathe her last. She tells Imam Ali that, oh Ali, I have a special wasiyah just for you. I want only you to listen to it. Please ask everyone to leave. One by one, the children are asked to leave the room. It is only Imam Ali and Sayyida Fatima in that room. Imam Ali alayhi salam goes near her. She is wasted away. She is very thin. She is sick. He places her head on his lap. She begins to explain what she wants to convey to him, her last wishes. She tells him, to paraphrase, that, oh Ali, I have been in your home all this time. I have tried my best to serve. I have tried my best to do my duty. Will you accept this from me? Is it something that you are pleased with? Imam Ali, when he hears her say this, he is so overcome. He takes her and he presses her to his chest. And he says, don't talk like this, O Fatima. These are not the words I wish for you to say. You trouble me so much when you speak like this. From you, there is no question of any type of disobedience. I am indeed pleased with you. She then goes on to make the requests of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of those requests that she says is, oh Ali, when it comes to burying me, then bury me at night and don't allow any of them to take place in this funeral. I want only you and the close family members to be there when you bury me. One of the great tragedies of history that Sayyida Fatima left behind for us, one of the great proofs of the dhulm that took place to her, is that the question is asked, which is, where is the grave of the only daughter of Rasulullah? Where is the grave of Sayyidatu Nisa al-Alameen? And nobody can answer that question today. Nobody, is that not a cause of shame for the Muslims that we cannot know where that grave is? That we cannot go and pay our respects and say our salam and seek shafa at the grave of the daughter of Rasulullah? According to one tradition, when Imam Ali alayhi salam does the job of bathing the blessed body at night time, there's a small party that is making their way towards the graveyard and towards the masjid of Rasulullah. This small party, who is part of that? There's just Imam Ali and Hassan and Hussein and perhaps Zainab and Umm Kulthum, and according to some narrations, some of the special companions of Imam Ali like Salman and Miqdad and Abu Dharr. According to one narration, Imam Ali orders that 40 graves be dug in the area. The next day, when they come to see what has taken place, they see that there are 40 graves that have been dug. They get worried. They realize that they don't know where the grave of Sayyida Fatima is. They don't know where they're going to go to. This is going to be a great stain on their history. One of them orders that have the women come to the graveyard. Let them dig up each one of these 40 graves until they find the blessed body of Fatima, so that we can, with this excuse, so that we can say our prayers there. Word reaches Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Imam Ali goes to the graveyard. He is wearing his special abba that he would wear only in tough situations. He tells them that if you wish to know who I am, This is Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is Ali, the son of Abu Talib. And I'm telling you now that no one among you is not going to even touch one stone from these graves. Otherwise they will face my sword. He takes Dhul-Fiqar and he places it firmly in the ground in front of him. One of them tries to come to him and to reason with him and to tell him that, what is wrong with you, O Abu al-Hasan? All we wish to do is to find that grave so that we can say our prayers on it, that we can make our dua there. Imam Ali al-Islam takes his sword and he slashes it and it cuts off a piece of cloth from that person's garment. And he says that, as for my right, I have left it aside for the benefit of the Muslims. وَأَمَّا قَبْرُ فَاطِمَةَ But the grave of Fatima, فَوَالَّذِي نَفْسِي عَلَيَّ بِيَدِهِ I swear by the one who has his soul, my soul in his hands, that if you and your companions even take one stone from it, you will, that the earth will be quenched with your blood. So do whatever you wish to do and then you will see what happens. This is the type of difficulties that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam has to face. But let us see now what this one man is doing, Amir al-Mu'mineen. In the nights after everyone has gone to sleep in Medina, there was one Amir al-Mu'mineen who would sneak out when no one could see him, and he would make his way towards a special grave, the grave of his deceased wife, Sayyidatun Nisa al-Alameen. He would go there and he would pour his heart out to her. He would remember this great lady and he would speak to her. Such beautiful poetry Amir al-Mu'mineen would compose, just describing the relationship that he would have and how much he missed this great lady. And one time she cries out, Mali waqaftu ala al-quburi musallima qabr al-habibi falam yarudda jawabi. I am standing here at the grave of my beloved, but she is not responding to my call to her. أَحَبِيبُ مَالَكَ لَا تَرُدُّ جَوَابَنَا Oh my beloved, why are you not responding to me? أَنَسِيتَ بَعَدِي خِلَّةَ الْأَحْبَابِ Have you forgotten me? Have you forgotten Ali? Have you forgotten how it is to be separated from the beloved ones? And then Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to answer his own question. He goes on to answer, قال الحبيب وكيف لي بجوابكم وأنا رهين جنادل وترابي Oh my beloved, how can I possibly answer you? Oh Ali, how can I respond to you? After all, here I am Zahra, I am Fatima, but I am trapped in this mound of rubble and dust underneath the ground. Please accept my apology, O Ali, for not responding to you. Ala la'natullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimeen, wa si'alamu al-ladhina zalamu ayyaman qalabin yanqalibun. Ma'atul Hussain.